Today's podcast is brought to you by Newspapers.com, your portal to the past. If you're like me and can't get enough of untold stories and forgotten tales, you're in for a treat. Newspapers.com has nearly a billion pages of historical newspapers dating back to the 1690s, and you can search them all in seconds. It's a treasure trove waiting for curious minds like yours. And with papers from across the US, UK, Canada, Australia, and beyond, Newspapers.com is the ultimate resource to unearth the stories that shaped our world. And here's something special for our history-loving listeners. Newspapers.com is offering an exclusive discount. Use the code HISTORYUNPLUGGED and get 20% off your subscription. That's promo code HISTORYUNPLUGGED, one word, at Newspapers.com. It's like having your own time machine to explore the stories that made history come alive. One more time, HISTORYUNPLUGGED, promo code at Newspapers.com.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, the unscripted show that celebrates unsung heroes, myth busts historical lies, and rediscovers the forgotten stories that changed our world. I'm your host, Scott Rank. In this episode, we're going to return to a topic that I looked at several months back in this podcast, and that is the harem. Specifically, I talked about the Ottoman Imperial Harem. This is a really fascinating topic for Europeans for centuries because no foreigners were allowed to enter it. And for a lot of people, they imagine it as basically the pre-modern version of the Playboy Mansion, where there's all sorts of licentiousness happening behind closed doors. But even though a sultan could have four wives and unlimited concubines, the harem wasn't the sensual fantasy land. It was more of an imperial cadet academy where foreign girls are turned into the wives of aristocrats and even future sultans, and there's all sorts of jockeying for power for women to become a concubine, maybe even a wife of a sultan, because if her son then becomes sultan, she can exercise enormous power, and there were in fact women who essentially ran the empire. To expand upon this topic, I'm speaking with University of Kansas professor Marie Grace Brown. Marie is a historian of the modern Middle East. She looks at the life of women in the Middle East. Specifically, she's studied Sudan in Khartoum, and she's the author of the book Khartoum at Night, Fashion and Body Politics in Imperial Sudan. We start by discussing the harem, which isn't just at the Istanbul Imperial Palace, but is more broadly defined to mean a female space. And she discusses what was it like for women in the Middle East as we enter into the modern period, where you have growing levels of education for women, civic participation, and the entering of women into public spaces, but you don't necessarily have westernization. So we talk about what's the difference between modernization and westernization. But we don't get too academic because at one point I asked Marie, let's say you're a female, you're transported to the pre-modern era in the Middle East. How would you take power? Would you work through the harem? Would you work through some other institution to become more powerful than a sultan? So Marie does a great job of getting to the depths of pretty academic ideas, but communicating them in a really engaging way, which a lot of people do not do well. So I enjoyed this discussion. I hope you do too. And look at the lives of women in schools, hospitals, parliaments, harems, and everything else you can imagine in the Middle East. Marie, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
Let's talk about something that is the greatest Orientalist fantasy of all. Writers of the 19th century love to talk about the harem. So would you please walk us through the harem, maybe the Ottoman harem, which I've talked about before, or a Sudanese harem. If you're a cadet entering the harem, what is it like?
Yeah, absolutely. So first, perhaps to clarify the fantasy that you're referring to, right, that appears in so much Western fiction and art. Which is the harem as a place of exoticism, sensuality, sexual fulfillment, women as perhaps submissive or oppressed, living lives that are secluded only to serve the man of the household. So that's the fantasy notion, right? But what we know in reality is that harem simply refers to the private quarters in a household, right? It is mm-hmm. where women spend most of their time, most of their lives, and children, both male and female, spend time in the harem. And so right off the bat, right, that this is not necessarily a place of just sex, right? But it is the family center. It is where decisions are made. It is where domestic politics plays out, and it is really sort of the heart of the home. And that's a generalized description, but that fits for much of the Middle East, for much of the 18th, 19th, and early 20th centuries. In the Northern Sudan case is slightly more different. It plays on those same notions as the harem being a secluded space. But in Sudan, they also have a very clear concept of enclosure. And so that and it is organized as sort of concentric circles. And so that there is the harem at the center of the household that moves farther out to the house itself, moving out into the yard, to the neighborhood, to the town. And so what we sort of see that's happening in the early 20th century, which is where my research focuses on, is we see women steadily moving farther and farther out into these concentric circles, moving farther and farther outward. What is unique and perhaps revolutionary about that is that this concept of enclosure or a harem system in Sudan is particularly conservative, even up until the 1940s and 50s in comparison with its Middle East neighbors like Egypt, so that you have strictures of the harem existing in northern Sudan far longer than you do in other places in the Middle East.
Huh. One thing that the Ottoman harem is famous for is all the political jockeying. Mm-hmm. People imagine when the harem is, it's basically like the Playboy mansion with a Hugh Hefner as the Sultan
right.
and the
sure.
bunnies as the ladies. But no. In the Ottoman case, it's a soap opera of jockeying for power where if you can marry the Sultan, bear his son, you become a wife. There are women who essentially ran the empire. In the Sudanese case or other cases that you've seen, is it like this as well, this political jockeying?
Absolutely, although it certainly also depends on what time period you're talking about. So the political jockeying that you're referencing absolutely makes sense for sort of high classical Ottoman period up until the 18th century. What you begin to see in the Arab Middle East, which is what I'm more familiar with, is a turn to a more nuclear family at the end of the 19th century and into the early 20th. And this is absolutely part of a larger modernizing project, part of a project to prove sort of equity with European Western standards of what a family looks like. And so you have less opportunity for political jockeying simply because you have less characters within this harem, right? So mm-hmm. you absolutely may have men with multiple wives, but that's becoming more and more uncommon. And so the harem by the 20th century as it exists, right, is housing smaller numbers of people who and because of that, their interests perhaps align a little bit more than the sort of soap opera quality
right.
that drives so much of Ottoman history.
Hmm. Well, that's interesting. If you have a country where polygamy is still allowed, you can still have multiple wives, but it's still moving toward a nuclear family model. Why would it move toward that model when they're not accepting, you know, Western laws on marriage and monogamy and things like that?
Sure. So having multiple wives is expensive, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
so certainly even in the Ottoman case, right, it is only the most elite that can have these
like
sort of large cadres. Right.
Yeah,
large cadres
much.
Of women. So part of And I wouldn't say so. There is, on the one hand, right, this move to modeling family life or nuclear family life on this new notion that the nuclear family is the civilized family. It is the modern family. That aligns with beliefs in child rearing and nationalism and citizenship. Huh. So that strong families, strong nations are made of strong families, and strong families arise from mothers who can pay careful attention to their children. So you should have a smaller number of children rather than a larger number. You follow this sort of thread back so that you have programs for girls' education, so that educated girls become educated wives and most importantly become educated mothers to raise strong citizens for this strong nation. So this this adoption of this new family structure, you're absolutely right, does seem like it's sort of all about westernizing and thus is in conflict with a resistance to adopting other kinds of Western laws or Western morals. But if you put it in the larger context of not westernizing but modernizing, and the notion that mm-hmm. a modern right. family and a modern state are absolutely linked, then you can sort of hold both of those things at the same time. So traditional Islamic values, lives that are guided by largely by religious law, and have that apply to a new, smaller family structure.
Yeah, that's a big issue of modernization without Westernization.
Absolutely.
And I won't bore listeners with the billions of pages on this on the historiography in the Middle East. But could you talk about that and something you mentioned earlier about the widening concentric circles mm-hmm. of women in Sudan? What does that process look like? And could you also touch on the modernization without Westernization?
Right, absolutely. So an example would be something like girls' education, right? Mm-hmm. So that in northern Sudan, and I should clarify for listeners that we're using Sudan as a shorthand, but my expertise is on the northern portion, which is predominantly Arab and Muslim. And so that's what I'm referring to. That within northern Sudan at the turn of the 20th century, there is very little formal education for girls. The British come in and conquer Sudan in 1898 and begin to establish educational programs for young girls. And part of my own research is on bodies and how bodies move and how the imperial experience is a physical experience. And so as an example of this, for the first time, girls are expanding those concentric circles, right, and walking from the house to their school, often unaccompanied. So that's very big, that this takes them away from their chores within the home. And because these are British schools that they're going to and taught by British women, you know, propriety and modesty are incredibly important. And so these young girls have to dress in an appropriate way. And so there are, they begin to adopt a large outer wrapper called a tobe. If you imagine a sari like women wear in India, this is very similar. It's a large rectangular cloth that women wrap around themselves. And the tobe had primarily been a garment for married women, but now you get young unmarried schoolgirls wrapping this garment around them simply so that they can go to school. The school also then teaches sewing as well as hygiene and reading and writing and arithmetic. And so these young girls become, you know, quite literally shaped and molded in an image of sort of European standards of civility, modesty, cleanliness, certainly. But what was interesting in the Sudan case, which is unlike other cases in the British Empire, there were a number of sort of political diplomatic agreements that went on. And so religion is not taught in these government schools, whether Christianity or Islam. And there's also, again, in northern Sudan, very few missionary schools. There are some, mm-hmm. but very few. And so this is an entirely what we would refer to as secular education for these girls. And so they are moving beyond the boundaries of their homes. They're dressed in new ways. Their face is washed in sort of new ways. Their bodies are moving in new ways. And yet there has been no threat to them as Muslim women, right? Or no challenge to their status as Muslim women.
I'm guessing these would be mostly the daughters of elites.
It is the daughters of elites, but the education program expands relatively rapidly, and there's sort of a hierarchy for how girls get chosen. And it is certainly elites, but once that happens, then you move down to sisters of people that have been in the school, then to now it's escaping me. elites, siblings, something else that I can't remember, and then by age, right? And one sort of interesting anecdote is that almost none of these girls have birth certificates or any sort of documentation that would match British bureaucratic standards to prove age. And so a girl's age was judged by how many adult teeth she had in her mouth. And
pretty inexact science there. Yeah.
It is a very inexact science. But parents were aware of this, and parents were actually quite eager to have their daughters enrolled in school and would lie about their child's age,
yeah,
either up or down, depending on where there were slots.
I could see ways to try to, dentures, or were there ways to try to goose the system?
Well, and nothing that elaborate,
okay,
but insisting that your 7-year-old daughter was in fact 5, or the other way, because education was in fact quite valued, and so getting your daughters into the system any way possible was very important.
So if I understand correctly, that the education, it being secular, it didn't threaten, I guess, their Islamic identity, and this is the modernization you're talking about without Westernization. So how else does gender identity change in Sudan getting into the 20th century with education? How does that affect women once they grow up? Maybe they have a career, they return to home life, but now they're educated in a way their mothers weren't. So
mm-hmm.
how does this also affect gender relations?
Right. And so this gets back to our notion of the concentric circles and women moving out. So there is, right, this movement of girls leaving the home, becoming educated, returning to the home, and then becoming wives, and the fears that they lose whatever education they've gained. But what is also happening, right, is a sort of a flexibility or an opening up for women to take part in public space. And so you have girls growing up becoming teachers themselves, becoming nurses, midwives. In the 1940s, there is a very strong women's activist movement, which is incredible if you think that the first schools for girls didn't begin until the 1920s. So you have, in sort of the span of just a little under a generation, a group of young women who feel confident enough, right, to sort of claim a space for themselves in public, right? And then And not only just sort of claiming sort of their rights to walk through the streets, but then to also say things like to make political claims, right? So claims for representation in legislature, the right to vote, the right to run for office, the right to maternity leave, the right to equal pay for equal work, right? All of these are demands made by some women activist groups in the 1940s and 50s. And so this changes gender relations in that now women are envisioning places for themselves and roles for themselves, not just in the home, but in the larger body politic, and then also the government, the nation, the state.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Lucky Land Casino asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
It's interesting to see also in different Muslim countries, rights women do and don't have. It's not as if Sharia is this one-size-fits-all package that mm-hmm. women can have tremendous freedom in one domain, but much less, and then the situation is flipped in other countries. So, for example, in Sudan today, I guess we'll talk about North Sudan, mm-hmm. is polygamy still legal there?
I believe so. Yeah, I believe so. And I think what's important to certainly Sudan, the government of Northern Sudan operates along a version of Sharia law. Mm-hmm. But I think what's important to sort of create a distinction is that Islamic law is one thing, right? But that is overlaid a particular culture too, right? Mm-hmm. And so what is often categorized as this is a religious law, is sort of a sloppy association, right? Because religious law is applied by humans at particular moments in very specific social and economic, political, historical situations. So the Islamic culture that exists in Northern Sudan is a descendant or is inherited of a very particular, stringent Islamic movement of the late 19th century. And so it is coming out of that. So Sudan today in the 21st century is sort of the descendant of a particular historical moment in which Islamic law was applied with pretty rigorous standards.
With ways that you talked about women's movements and education, when most people hear that, they would imagine a fundamental clash with Islamic law, mm-hmm. like you just described. But as you know, we've read in a lot of places, it's much more complicated. Sometimes there's conflict. Sometimes mm-hmm. they support each other. So the discourse of what we would call modern things in Sudan, education, other things that you mentioned, is it understood by the people who practice them? Do they add a Islamic coding to it and call it Islamic, or do they recognize that the source might have been British, and or do they try to negate that source? How do they come to terms with things that are modern and Islamic? Do they just make it all Islamic, or?
Yeah, and I think so what I don't see is And this is sort of a ridiculous example, but people saying, oh, this is an Islamic radio, or mm-hmm. this is an Islamic novel or something like that, right? So these sort of cultural exchanges that come along with education are adopted and accepted, and the caution is sort of really on how should one use them, right? And what is appropriate to be spread. So I think that one of perhaps the clearest examples, thinking again about women and gender, is changing notions of beauty and fashion, which is, again, mm-hmm. what a lot of my research focuses on. And in the women's magazines that I studied, again, pulling from the 1950s and early into the early 1960s, there's a lot of talk about changing beauty standards and Hollywood starlets. There's one of my favorite cartoons that appears in a magazine is of a one woman spies another walking down the street, and the woman walking down the street is in a tight mini dress and high heels. So the protagonist decides she also wants to wear high heels, and she buys herself a pair and promptly trips and falls over. And so the message of that, obviously, is that beauty comes not from high heels, but from something else. But there is no language that says, oh, you have to, putting aside the more radical outliers, right, that the mainstream mm-hmm. language is not saying, oh, we have to ignore Hollywood completely, or, oh, all Western beauty standards are terrible and should be ignored. It's really about moderation and finding a balance and finding sort of what is beautiful and elegant within oneself. And so sometimes that means doing things in a more quote unquote traditional way. And sometimes that means adapting what's sort of new and coming in within, again, sort of a Sudanese culture. I should note, right, that it's not just women that are responding to these things too, right? In fact, at the forefront of all of this is Sudanese men who are educated to a greater extent than Sudanese women, are educated earlier than Sudanese women are. And so the first line of all of these notions about what beauty looks like, romantic notions of love and companionship and new forms of marriage, all of that actually comes through men first, who are reading novels, seeing foreign films, reading essays, perhaps traveling to the West and then returning home. So you actually also see men beginning to demand women, and this is I'm paraphrasing a quote here, right? But women who look like Greta Garbo.
Mm-hmm.
So that, you know, changing gender norms are really the result of men and women working together to define what's authentic, what's new, what's beautiful, what's not allowed.
Hmm. You mentioned something interesting before we started recording, that in your teaching you try to help students see things that appear to be foreign or different in the Middle East aren't as different as we think. And the terms that we're using here, we talk about Sharia, we're talking about polygamy. To a casual listener, when they hear Sharia and think about the rights of women, they think of the Taliban or ISIS mm-hmm. or Wahhabism. That, well, how are those two things even in the same galaxy? But how would you go about teaching when you talk about how things aren't as different as we would assume in the Middle East when we're looking at issues of women's rights, even in a country where Sharia is practiced? And you mentioned that it's not a monolithic term, mm-hmm. but how do you go about explaining that?
Right. And I think one of the things to do is to that I try and do is remind my students that the people that we are studying are humans. Mm-hmm. So they are motivated by the same sort of base desires, power, sex, money, love, legacy. They can be irrational, right? Just like mm-hmm. we are sometimes. So students often ask, well, why did they do this? Or what is that decision? And sometimes the answer is they're human. Mm-hmm. But I think the other thing that I try and do is present some of these larger movements. So let's say, again, recognizing that things like ISIS and Al-Qaeda are absolute outliers. But let's say a general turn to Islamic conservatism, which has happened throughout the Middle East, starting in the 1990s, to sort of ask, well, what problems are these populations facing? What solutions have been proposed that haven't provided answers? And those solutions are wrapped up in sort of corrupt government systems, capitalism that hasn't worked, communism that hasn't worked. And so how might religion then provide another answer to questions about or to frustrations about, I don't feel like my government responds to me or hears me. I don't feel like my government treats me or my neighbors or my community fairly. I've gotten an education, but I can't find a job, and so I'm hungry. I have trouble getting a permit to build a house, and without a house, I can't get a wife, I can't have children, right? So there's this sort of permanent adolescence. All of those, right, are frustrations that we can all sort of identify with, right? Economic mm-hmm. frustrations, personal and social frustrations and challenges. And then to and once we've established that, we can say, well, now what does religion offer as a solution? And Islam is unique among the Abrahamic religions in that it comes sort of built into it a political system as well, right? And so Islam sort of already has a lot of these answers for what should the tax rate be, or what do you do, you know, when you encounter orphans, right? So these kinds of things, Islam sort of already provides those answers in the way that Christianity and Judaism in their sacred texts don't necessarily. I guess I think that that's part of how I attempt to humanize things. And I think, you know, it's an uphill battle because the way that the media talks about the Middle East and Islam, not even in 2017, but, you know, we can go back to 2001, 2002, is so isolating and distancing. I believe I'm trying to remember the event that prompted Newsweek to run a cover that was called Muslim Rage. I don't think it was related to the Arab Spring, but it must have been some other uprising.
Yeah, it was the one, the Roots of Muslim Rage, something
like
that.
So the cover was just a bunch of brown bearded men shaking their fists in the midst of yelling. The article, right, was that Muslim rage was a foregone conclusion, right? That there is always – that Muslims are always angry, right? And that mm-hmm. Muslim men are always dangerous. And in response to that, a lot of Muslims worldwide, but definitely in the United States and Europe, started tweeting funny responses with the hashtag Muslim Rage. So, one of them was...
My falafel is overcooked, Muslim Rage, yeah.
Right. Or one night stand and my date only has bacon for breakfast, Muslim Rage, right? So all of these things that were just about, sort of humanizing or sort of recognizing that the people... That these are people, right? That these aren't others. Getting back to this notion of the exotic harem, right? Mm-hmm. These aren't people living in a picture or a film, but that they're facing the same daily struggles that we are.
Yeah, and in terms of Islam's engagement with modernity, when I talked with my class about fatwas, it seems like newer fatwas, two-thirds of them have to do with smartphones. Mm-hmm. Of can I read the Quran on a smartphone? It just goes on endlessly.
Yeah, right. I mean, and so Islam, and like many religions, but Islam certainly is incredibly adaptive. So Hassan al-Banna, who is the founder of the Muslim Brotherhood, so he founds the Muslim Brotherhood in 1938, and he lists and his idea is to turn Egypt, which has not been working very well as a constitutional monarchy, into a fully religious state, one that better follows religious laws. But he's absolutely engaging with this question of modernity. And so he does answer questions about what kinds of things should be broadcast on a radio, or how should men and women mix in cinemas or cafes. He also has sort of a large socialist bent, too, and so has instructions for workers' rights and mandatory vacations and things like that, so that there's actually been sort of a history, right, of Islamic political thinkers attempting to adapt Islam, right, for this modern age and to make it relevant and sort of flexible.
When you were in Sudan from 2010 to 2012, were doing field research and talking with women and many others there. Mm-hmm. Is there anything that sticks out from your encounters with people that highlight some of these things we're discussing?
I'll say a few things. And one sort of corrective: I was not there for 2 years, which would have been amazing. So I was there in 2010, and then again in 2012. I think one of the things that I had to encounter sort of thinking about gender was, so, you know, I am a strong, independent, American, brash woman capable of doing everything, or used to doing everything myself, right? And getting used to in Sudan to that a woman of my social status would not just be sort of boldly striding down the street to get wherever she needed to go. And so getting used to having drivers, so either hiring cabs or people that I was meeting with would, say, well, oh, you know, take my driver home. I got used to, there was a man who had one of the better cabs that, and he sort of always positioned himself right outside my apartment because he knew he could overcharge me and things like that. Oh, and it was fine, absolutely fine. But one day he was on the drive and he was saying that he was going to turn on the air conditioning with the nod that this would cost me more. And I was saying, you know, oh, I don't need the air conditioning. And he said, but absolutely. He said, a woman like you going to an important meeting, you need air conditioning. You can't show up sweaty and disheveled. And he was absolutely right. I mean, he was that for what I was attempting to do and for the person that I was sort of trying to portray, a woman of my stature would not show up sweaty. She would absolutely pay for air conditioning. So things like that in that I had to learn sort of how to adjust my body to their norms. And in meaning that that my body was something that needed to be protected, right? And taken care of. And I wasn't used to that. I'll tell another story since I'm thinking about drivers. So I met and became friendly with sort of a very lovely family of a economics professor at the University of Khartoum. And so I would often go over to his house for a meal. And so he would have his son, his young teenage son, then drive me home. And his son had, I guess I don't even know what he was playing, but he had Adele's latest album is the point of this story. And so in sort of that 20-minute ride home, this young man who I didn't know very well, and he certainly didn't know me, we just sang Adele on the rides home, and it was great. It was lovely. And it was this sort of nice moment of international connection. And
yeah, globalization for people when they first travel abroad, it's baffling the things that people are into. Someone I knew who is very one of the most fundamentally religious people I knew in Turkey was a huge fan of all the Ernest movies. Mm-hmm. Ernest Goes to Camp, Ernest Goes to Jail. And So I would like to do a thought experiment. I like to do this with guests. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't work. And one who is a medievalist, I asked him, how would you kick off the modern age? And his answer was to start contract law and I think bring potatoes from the okay. New world. So here's my thought experiment for you.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say you're in, you could choose the Ottoman Empire, Sudan at some point. It's in a pre-modern era. And we talked at the top of this podcast how there were certain women who basically ran the empire
sure.
Through the harem. Let's say you want to take power in your state. How would you go about doing that? Would you move through the harem? Would you move through some other institution? So in terms of women working through society in, you know, sometimes formal or informal channels or using those channels to assert themselves, how would you become the most powerful person? And maybe you're not the Sultan in name, but, you know.
For am all I a woman in this?
Yeah, in this scenario, okay. You're a woman. So how do you take power?
Well, I don't think my answer is novel in any way in that you marry strategically and then you birth child, ideally a son, right, and position him in an appropriate way, right? And the Ottoman Empire, that often requires killing off competitors, right, mm-hmm. male and female. And, you know, birthing a daughter, you have a few more steps to get to the center of power, right, because then she has to marry well also or become a sexual partner. But, I think there is I think the lesson, right, is not that sex is important and that power travels through sex, which is true, right? But that thinking about domestic space as the space in which all sorts of political strings are pulled and maneuvered, right? And this is why I think gender is such an important category of analysis for historians, right? And expanding beyond that to think about to looking at as families, as households of historical analysis, because these lines that we've drawn between public space and private space don't exist for the people who live them, right? You have a bad day at work and then you come home and whatever is happening at home either soothes what's going on or exacerbates it, right? And so I think that we that women's power, right, is through the family. And the tragedy or the difficulties come when women can't have children, right? Mm-hmm. And so the ways then becomes sort of much harder when family is valued and legacy is valued and inheritance is valued to insert yourself into that power node if you are a woman. And I'll also say for the benefits of your listeners, right, that I am a woman of color. And so at any given historical moment, women of color would have also had larger disadvantages and greater challenges to sort of move your way into the center of power.
Yeah, we've started in the home, moved outwards, and then came back in a very large circle that wraps up the entire Middle East. So if people want to read more about the research you have done, what is the name of your book?
Right, wonderful. So my book just came out. It is called Khartoum at Night, Fashion and Body Politics in Imperial Sudan. And I will say that it is absolutely written for the educated lay reader.
Okay, so not chapters of historiography.
No,
and
zero. Yeah, zero of them.
Fantastic. Great, and I'll link to that in the show notes if people want to check it out. Marie, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Scott.
Well, that was the interview with Marie Grace Brown. Again, if you'd like to check out her book, Khartoum at Night, I have a link to that in the show notes, which you can find at historyunplugpodcast.com. Thanks for listening. See you next time. Thanks for listening to the History Unplugged podcast. Be sure to subscribe to the show to get your daily dose of all things history related, from ancient Greece to the Cold War. You can do that by going to historyonthenet.com/subscribe. Speaking of History on the Net, If you want to dive deeper, go to our site, historyonthenet.com, and there you'll find blog posts, book reviews, and all of our other podcast episodes. Plus, don't forget to rate and review this podcast so we can bring you the best daily history content possible. We'll see you next time at the History Unplugged podcast.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
This episode is brought to you by Calitrin. Text the word unplug to 30605, and I'll send you a link to a wonderful product that can help you finally succeed in shedding that extra weight. I took Calitrin for several weeks last year, and I felt great in several ways. I felt stronger. My workouts felt easier. I slept better. I was noticeably trimmer. There was no downside. Text the word unplug to 30605 right now to see this week's special offer on Calitrin. Calitrin contains collagen, the most abundant protein naturally occurring in the human body, which decreases as we age. Taking Calitrin promotes better sleep, more energy, less joint pain, and best of all, weight loss. Calitrin has an 86% success rate with their 90-day supply, and this week, take advantage of my special offer. Buy the 90-day supply and get an extra month free plus free shipping. Ordering is easy. Just text the word unplugged to 30605 and I'll send you a link to the special offer. Again, text unplugged to 30605.